Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This morning, we'll hear about a program designed for individual and family counseling, family mediation, and emergency temporary shelter for youth who are at crisis. We're going to talk to one of WDEV's all-stars, Brian Harwood, and we're going to learn about a UVM professor who's analyzing those tweets that you're sending out. But we're going to start with an amendment that has been proposed for Vermont's Constitution that requires one more vote by the legislature before it can be put to the state's voters. It's the Reproductive Liberty Amendment, or Proposal 5. We're going to learn about what the amendment proposes, what steps are left in the process. Joining me now is Lucy LaRiche. She's Vice President of Vermont Public Policy for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Lucy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also Felicia Kornblue, Professor of Women's and Gender Studies at UVM. Felicia, great to have you here as well this morning.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question or thoughts for our guests about the amendment, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Our email is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Lucy, what does the Reproductive Liberty Amendment specifically cover?
The amendment would ensure that individual Vermonters can choose for themselves whether and when to become a parent, use temporary or permanent birth control, or seek abortion care.
And Felicia, why was this amendment proposed in the first place?
Well, we're at an extraordinary moment right now, as people probably know, in terms of abortion rights and other reproductive rights around the country. And so when we look to what's happening in Texas, what's happening in Mississippi, the deliberations that are happening right now in the Supreme Court around abortion rights, and when we think about what's happening more broadly in terms of reproductive rights, there have been scares about involuntary sterilization in recent years, not in Vermont, but in other states. And so we thought, I think, and many of us think, that it's important to enshrine those rights in our state constitution, which is our fundamental law, the most important body of law that we have in the state.
Well, Felicia, why an amendment to the Constitution as opposed to passing a state law?
Well, from my perspective, it has two purposes. One is symbolic, and the other is really practical. So symbolically, I think it says these are rights, these are issues, this is a kind of liberty and freedom that we in Vermont care so much about that we're going to put it in our most important body of law. It's hard to change the Constitution, and that's on purpose, right? That's true at the national level. It's true in every single state. It's hard to change the state constitution. It's a slow process. It's a deliberative process where we really talk to each other about what our values are, right? So so when we get to that point of changing our constitution, then it's a result of a broad agreement about the rights and liberties that we value. So I think that's symbolic, especially in this national context we're in, but also here in the state. And then practically, it just means that these rights, these liberties are going to be pretty immune to change, right? That if there's just a law from the legislature, that can be changed in the next biennium of the legislature, right? They can change it at any time. But if it's in the Constitution, it's going to be a higher bar. It's going to be harder to shift in the wind if something happens. And again, that's by design.
Yeah.
We want the things that we care the most about to be the hardest to change.
So, and hardest to get approved in the first place. So, Lucy, let's talk through those steps of what's gone through so far, you know, exactly what it takes to have this amendment change to the Constitution, or amendment added to the Constitution.
Sure. Yes, it's to amend the Vermont State Constitution, there's a process outlined within our Constitution. It requires affirmative votes by both chambers of the legislature, the House and the Senate, in two consecutive legislatures. That means there's an election in between those two bienniums. So two different legislatures, duly appointed legislatures, will have to consecutively approve the amendment in both chambers in order for it to pass. So far, as you mentioned at the top of the program, the House and the Senate approved the amendment in 2019 with overwhelming tripartisan support. And then in this next, then we had our 2020 elections, a new legislature was seated, and the Vermont Senate last year passed the amendment again with overwhelming support, tripartisan support, and now this year in 2021, the legislative session that begins in January, the House of Representatives will be taking it up, I believe, in January, early in the session, because they think this is really important as they see what's happening at the national level. And once it passes the House this second time, it will go to the voters, and it will be decided on exactly a year from today, on Election Day, November 2022.
And, Lucy, does it require the signature of the governor at any point?
No, it doesn't. It does go to the governor after it's passed by the House as a procedural measure it has to go through. But the governor doesn't have any actual authority on whether it moves through the process.
So, Felicia, it's moving through the process right now. What kind of support has the amendment had, as it has been voted on previously by the Senate and the House?
Well, the amendment has been really robustly supported. And I'll just say again, it is called the Reproductive Liberty Amendment, or RLA, sometimes also has been known as Proposition Number 5. And it has been really well supported. We're entering a new phase today, though. Today is the launch of the campaign for the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. And so what we're hoping for from people who are listening is that more and more people would join the coalition of support. And you can do that by communicating with your House members, your representatives, and tell them how important you think it is for them to vote on this. And also any organizations that you belong to, if they want to join the Coalition for the Reproductive Liberty Amendment, they should definitely join, and you should talk to them about that. So there are many organizations now that are supporting this campaign, and we expect to see more and more over the next year from this day forward.
Lucy, who are members of this coalition who are supporting this proposal, this Proposition 5, the Reproductive Liberty Amendment?
Yeah, well, we have layers of participation. So we have the executive committee level, and we're just beginning recruitment at that level for people to join. So far, there's the Vermont ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Vermont chapter, has been on board since day one. Planned Parenthood Vermont Action Fund has definitely been at the table the whole time. And then in addition to that, we have A Better Vermont, just signed on. We are also having conversations with, I believe, VPIRG is having conversations and are very supportive, and it looks like they're going to be joining the steering committee, the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, and is what that acronym stands for, the Vermont chapter. And then we have a lot of other organizations that are considering it. Let's Go Kids, actually, we're having conversations with them. And in addition to that, we have lots of other organizations that are just supportive through endorsement. For example, the Vermont Medical Society, the Vermont Nurses Association, the Vermont Nurse Practitioners Association. I may have that name wrong, but the people who represent them, other labor unions are having a look at this. So our support is strong and growing every day.
Felicia, I don't know if you've done the history, if anybody has, but what do we know about how any other amendments that have been approved in this manner in Vermont's history?
I don't know about Vermont constitutional amendments. I know that nationally,
what's that,
yeah,
Lucy?
Go ahead, Lucy. Go ahead.
I can speak to the last the Vermont Constitution has been amended.
Okay.
I should say this amendment, if passed, would be the 22nd amendment that Vermonters have made to their to our Constitution. But in recent history, it has only happened once that I can remember in the last generation, and that is when we passed, I think it was in 2012 or 20, I think it was in 2012, an amendment that will allow minors, people who were not yet of legal voting age at the date of the primary, but would be of legal voting age at the day of the general election, to vote in the primary.
Right.
So that was the last time that the Constitution was amended. Not passed very easily, not controversial. So this is a big deal for Vermont. Vermont has not really seen a really large substantive kind of proposal of amendment to its Constitution in many years.
We're discussing.
And I was going to
say, please, Felicia.
At the national level, this would make. There has never been a state constitutional amendment like this before in United States history. So Vermont is really going to be a leader in this area, and I think that's very important for us. It's a very strong positive for us.
All right. Yeah, that's an excellent point to make. Lucy, if this goes to a vote of the people, I would imagine this doesn't escape the attention of advocacy groups for and against Proposition 5. As Felicia mentioned, first state in the country to go this route. So what kind of media blitz will we see in Vermont at that point?
That's a great question, Rick. I don't know what kind of media blitz. I'm hoping it's not crazy, explosive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we can expect to see a lot of people competing for, to be heard. And it's going to be potentially a very, it's an election year. So, there's going to be a lot of people running for office, and that's going to be pulled in. But yeah, it's true. We are first in the nation, and as such, it's really an honor. And I think for the most part, once Vermonters hear our message and understand that the Reproductive Liberty Amendment is really just about protecting Vermonters' rights to make their own reproductive decisions, that they will overwhelmingly support. The most controversial part of the Reproductive Liberty Amendment is the fact that it will protect abortion access. But when we say it's controversial, it's really a misnomer, because it's that the access to safe legal abortion is actually nationally very, very popular. Almost 80% of the U.S. population, Republicans, Democrats, independents, every party, believe that access to a safe legal abortion and that should be protected, and that Roe should not be overturned. So we know that this is something that Americans, Vermonters and Americans, value the right to make their own private healthcare decisions for themselves, and their right to determine their own life's course on their own. Nonetheless, abortion opponents will come in, we're sure, and as they often do, spread misinformation, misleading information, and try to distort the truth about what the amendment actually does. But we're ready, and we will be ready with our messages, and we're sure Vermonters will see through those deceptive messages from our opponents.
Felicia, you mentioned first in the country. Since Vermont has started the process, and which we're in the middle of now, of this amendment, have any other states stepped forward and done the same, or look to follow suit?
Well, I think this is a conversation in other states, especially as people view what's happening at the national level. And there's some national level strategists from the same organization that's bringing these big constitutional cases that are suggesting the Vermont way as a way forward for other states. And they're actually suggesting it for the national level as well. There are two kind of national solutions that for the current state of abortion rights, at least, that are being considered right now. One is a piece of legislation in the United States House of Representatives, but there also is talk about a national constitutional amendment and eventually building the momentum for that. So I think Vermont is still well ahead of any other state or the United States, but this is a strategy that many people are considering as we see the kind of the failure of what seems to be at least the failure of a strategy of relying on the Supreme Court to protect our rights and our liberties to make our own choices about our reproductive destinies.
I do want to ask you both this question, and it's a question that I think many people will wrestle with if it goes to a vote next November 2022. Felicia, why is this important for the rights of women in Vermont to have this amendment approved?
Well, first I'd say it's not just the rights of women. We're talking about the rights of all people who have reproductive capacity, so that means all people. And if we're talking about people being free, for example, from, you know, any pressure to be sterilized, right, that could be both people, men and women, and it could certainly be people who are non-binary or people who are transgender. But I think it's also, you know, it is important for all of us as a recognition of a part of our citizenship in this state and in this country that there are certain choices that are our choices to make, and they are not an appropriate area for the government to interfere with, and they're not an appropriate area for, you know, for our bosses or our supervisors or the companies that we're affiliated with to interfere with either. So I think it's fundamentally important to say this is an area of freedom that we as citizens and as members of this state really are entitled to.
And Lucy, same question for you. Why is this important for Vermonters to have this amendment approved?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Felicia said. Look, the decision of when and if to become a parent is among the most important decisions any human being makes in their lifetime. And to leave that decision up to politicians or other people is unacceptable. We need to make sure that we're protecting Vermonters' rights to determine their own destiny, their own path, their own future, and that they're calling the shots about when they parent and when they don't parent.
Now, Felicia, if this doesn't make it through the legislature this session, does the process go back to the very start? Is this scuppered completely?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
I think those of us who are in support of this amendment would be prepared to start over. But I do think that we have a good chance. And I think that if everyone who cares about this communicates with their legislators, that we have a really good opportunity here for this to pass the Vermont State House, and then therefore for us to have an opportunity as voters to vote on it 1 year from today as the Reproductive Liberty Amendment.
And then I would assume the same thing if it is turned down by the voters of the state. That specific proposal is now voted down, and the process again starts from the very beginning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. And those of us who care would start again.
All right. I just want to make sure that we have this correct. Now, Lucy, earlier this year, 20 Vermont religious leaders came out in support of a woman's right to choose. Not usually what one would expect. So why do you think they did that?
Yeah, actually, I don't think it's very surprising at all. The Catholic Church, of which I was, for, you know, full disclosure here, my mother was raised in a convent by nuns, and I was raised very Catholic. Unfortunately, we have the leadership of the Catholic Church in Vermont has, I think, created this perception that, those who have faith or faith leaders are anti-abortion, when in case that is not true at all. There are many, many Catholics across the country who believe in reproductive rights and who honor and are advocates for reproductive rights. And there are many leaders, faith leaders, across the spectrum of religion who believe similarly. So actually, I don't think it's surprising at all, but I think it is. I think it says a lot for the power of the Catholic leaders' messages in Vermont that that perception exists.
Felicia, as we understand it, it looks like Roe v. Wade is under some kind of a threat. If that was overturned by the Supreme Court, this particular amendment, would it still protect the reproductive rights of Vermonters despite what is decided on the national level?
Yes, and that's a really important question. So there are two cases now before the United States Supreme Court. One was argued last week about a Texas law, and then there's one that's going to be argued on December 1st about a Mississippi law. And we're likely to get a decision from the Supreme Court next spring or early summer. It's usually late May or early June when they decide very, very important issues. And the United States Supreme Court might well overturn Roe versus Wade from 1973 and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which are the two great landmarks. And if that were to happen, then this constitutional amendment would just be more important than ever. And we would want to be saying, we in Vermont would want to be saying even more powerfully that we stand for these rights and for this kind of liberty, that we believe that reproductive liberty is fundamental to who we are as Vermonters, as citizens of this state, and that that we are going to be, you know, a safe haven for people in this state and even possibly for, you know, people who might need to come here from other places in order to seek care for some of their reproductive needs. So I certainly hope that it won't come to that. And I don't know. But that might be the way things go. And then I do hope that other states follow our lead. You know, that Vermont is able to be kind of a beacon and set an example, and that many other states follow our lead.
Felicia Kornbluh is professor of women's and gender studies at UVM. Lucy LaRiche is vice president of Vermont Public Policy for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. I want to thank you both for being on the program this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks so much, Beck. Really appreciate you highlighting the Reproductive Liberty Amendment on your show.
All right. Thanks so much. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll be back to learn about the Country Roads Program. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. As part of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau, there is the Country Roads Counseling Services and Temporary Shelter Program. We're going to take the next half hour to learn about the various elements of the program and how you might be an ideal candidate to become a shelter parent for the program. Joining me to discuss Country Roads is the program director, Georgiana Birmingham. Georgiana, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We also have Executive Director of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau, Craig Pinkham. Craig, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you.
Good morning. And also Colleen Carroll, who is Country Roads Youth and Family Counselor. Colleen, I'm so glad you're here as well.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, listeners, to ask our guests about the work of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau and about Country Roads, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Craig, I want to start with you. What is the Washington County Youth Services Bureau?
Sure. So the Washington County Youth Service Bureau is Washington County's primary youth service, youth and young adult service agency. So we work with youth and families that range from the age of 12 to 26, with a variety of programs that run from our teen center in Montpelier in the basement of City Hall, all the way up to a residential program for young men who are transitioning out of adult corrections. In between that, we've got a gamut of services for youth and for families. But we also manage a number of statewide programs that help to develop and fund and support youth service agencies around the state. So we've got a little bit of a hand in both the direct service and in the statewide policy and implementation elements.
Georgiana, we're going to focus. There's a lot of programs that the Bureau does run, but we're going to focus this morning on the Country Roads program. So what is that program?
So the program is a mix of things. We have both state and federal funding, which allows us to work with teens and their families. And the idea is that we're trying to keep families together. So if we're trying to prevent runaway or having youth being pushed out of their homes, we're trying to prevent youth going into DCF custody or being involved with the juvenile justice system. Or if they are involved, we're trying to get them out of that system and use the community resources and their families to help them thrive.
How long has Country Roads been operating, and how many individuals are part of the program at any given time?
The program has been operating a long time. We think since the late 80s.
Okay.
We're not. I've been here 25 years. It's been going that long.
Okay.
I think we probably have in the range of 45 to 50 something youth at any given time.
Wow.
The shelter, one of the things we're talking about today is looking for shelter homes and people who are willing to step up for a short-term temporary to be a shelter parent. But that's just part of our program. We do a lot of family counseling, connection to other resources, and advocacy for youth to be able to stay in school or get the resources they need from school or get a job or repair relationships with family.
So, Colleen, talk about the program and the individuals who are part of the program and specifically what the program provides for these individuals.
Yeah, so working with the Country Roads program, we provide a few services with individual and family counseling. We do crisis intervention. This also looks into the temporary short-term shelter that we provide, as well as case management. And the youth that we often see are referred from the schools, are referred from DCF, and are sometimes self-referrals just from the work that we do within the community. So that's like a short glimpse of the services that we provide. A lot of these youth, I think it's safe to say, we are working with ages 12 to 22. Is our, like, demographic that we hit.
And, Craig, under whose jurisdiction is the Youth Service Bureau?
So the Bureau is a private nonprofit. So we are independent in that regard, though we work with a number of funders, as Georgiana mentioned, both state and federal funders. And so it's that governmental nonprofit partnership, I think, that sort of fuels a lot of this. But at the end of the day, we're an independent nonprofit.
Why is the Country Roads program, Craig, you know, one that you think is really important for your organization to be involved with and to offer?
Well, I think it's one of our cornerstone programs at the end of the day. We know and have learned a lot over the years around what is happening, you know, during adolescence. And it's a challenging time of transition and change. And being able to provide support to both youth and families during a really challenging time is really, it's at the core of what we do as an organization. So, you know, my take on the Country Roads program, whether you're talking about the counseling elements or the shelter, is it's kind of the bedrock of how we work in the community.
Georgiana, how do you see the youths in the program benefiting from being in it? Because I would imagine this is really the core of why the program exists and what you're all striving for every single day.
Sure. Well, you know, I think in general we're providing support for youth who are having a difficult time, and particularly with shelter, we're giving them a break from where conflict is happening for them so that they can get to a place where they're ready to engage with their families in a different way. And, I think that's generally it.
And how long would they typically be in the Country Roads program?
Well, in the shelter program, that runs one night to approximately 2 weeks, and it's voluntary, so they don't have to stay a specific amount of time. In our working with our program in general, we don't have time limits. We are often working with youth and families for quite some time, and then other youth come in for a month or 2 months or a few months and get some what support they need and move along.
Colleen, what is a shelter parent?
Yeah, so a shelter parent is a volunteer who has been screened by the Washington County Youth Service Bureau. They are volunteers from within the community who open up their homes to the youth that need a place to stay. They're pretty supportive individuals who just really care about that, supporting your local communities, which is something that we feel very strongly about.
And what are they required to provide?
So our shelter parents are required to provide lodging. So if they have a spare bedroom, loft, just an area where the youth can stay that, you know, is shut off from the rest of the home. So, like, they have, like, a bedroom. That's, like, a really good example. They're required to provide supervision, like, when the youth is home. So when they're not at school, it's expected that the shelter parent can, you know, be there and just provide some supervised adult interactions, meals, you know, that sort of thing. Like, if you take care of, like, any kids, it's the same expectations.
Mm-hmm. Craig, what type of screening do these shelter parents go through to make sure that they are a proper fit for the program?
Sure. So we take the, you know, the safety and well-being of any youth and family that we're working with very seriously. So each shelter parent can expect that, you know, we facilitate and pay for a number of both criminal and vulnerable population background checks with really everybody who's in the household. And we do those and we update those fairly regularly, at least once every other year. And anytime the composition of the house changes, in addition to those background checks, and in some respects, even more importantly, there's a pretty, you know, exhaustive period of really learning who that family is through interviews, through the a home visit, where the staff of the Country Roads program really develops a relationship with them. Because part of it is also about figuring out how best we can support the shelter parent in performing this really important role. And so does that interest meet with the sense that they've got the good temperament and fit that we're looking for someone who's taking on this responsibility? Because it's certainly challenging, you know, bringing someone into your home who's already in kind of a stressed and vulnerable moment. And, right. And we really are looking for parents who can, you know, shelter parents who can provide that moment of calm in the middle of some uncertainty. So we do a lot to get to know a potential prospect before we make a decision.
And Georgiana, what kind of support do the shelter parents receive monetarily, also with guidance to make sure that their time in this role is successful?
So we have a 24-hour line that shelter parents and youth can reach us at any time if there's something that they need to speak with us about. We also, like Craig said, have a relationship with those folks, so they often know how to reach us directly, even if they didn't go through the line. We currently pay $50 per night for shelter parents to have a youth in their home. The amount that shelter parents typically have youth is not very regular. So it's not something somebody's going to make money off of doing, but they're also not going to be taxed by having, by expenses of having somebody else in their home. So we're definitely covering them for any expenses that might come up.
Gotcha. Now, Colleen, Georgiana mentioned before that it could be anywhere from an overnight stay to about 2 weeks. How great is the need for shelter parents right now?
So it really depends on what the clients or individuals that are referred into the program are at. So at this moment, like, we are looking just to expand the shelter parents that we have within our call list in the Barrie and Montpelier areas. That's where we see a lot of our youth needing it, because or else we have to kind of have the youth go into, like, towns that are a little further out. So when we have the need for, like, the youth needing to, like, keep going to school at, like, Spalding or U32, so it's that need is there where it's, like, we can't seem to have, like, appropriate shelter homes available during, like, the school weeks.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. I'm sorry. That was a little.
That's all right. How many shelter parents, households do you typically have at one time?
It really depends on the shelter availability of the parents. I think right now we have a list of about 10 people.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it looks like there's definitely a great need right now. Craig, how do you see the youths in the program benefiting from having a shelter parent?
You know, I think the biggest thing in the moment, Rick, is a non-judgmental safe space. I mean, you know, our shelter parents are trained and supported to accept whatever is in the life of that youth and family in the moment. And it's not their job to question it. It's not their job to fix it. It's just their job to be there, to provide that shelter, to provide that quiet, you know, moment of respite, to give the youth and the family the time to start working, mending, and addressing whatever the challenge was. So I think, you know, what the youth get out of that is, you know, a guarantee that if it's for a night or for a week, they have a safe, dry, warm, supportive place that's not going to be, you know, pushing on the why are you here and what was done to kind of, you know, bring you to this moment. It's just a quiet acceptance.
Mm-hmm. And Georgiana, looking at it from the other side, what do you see that the shelter parent gains from this experience, being part of this process, being part of Country Roads?
Sure. Well, I think it's a way to be part of your community and to help others in your community, whether you're helping the youth directly or also the family who's having a rough time. And I, you know, I don't know how often you're with teenagers, Rick, but they're pretty fun. And funny. And so I do think it brings some joy hanging out with teenagers every once in a while.
Keeps you young. That's right, which is something we all strive for. Colleen, what do you think makes a good shelter parent?
I think what makes a good shelter parent is just, you know, the consistency and just, you know, being available and having the time to sit with the youth and hearing what they have to say and just reflecting that back to them.
And I would imagine whenever there is a need, a parent is called, someone on the call list is called to see if they can take them. But, you know, about how often would a person be asked to take someone in as part of the Country Roads program, Colleen?
Well, we try to respect if a shelter parent already provided shelter earlier on in, like, that month, we will try looking to see if there are any other good fits. Because we don't want to exhaust any of the shelter parents that we're working with, and we really respect and appreciate the time and availability and support that they give us in helping these youth that we're working with.
Georgiana, what is the application process for someone who is interested in becoming a shelter parent for the Bureau?
Well, we have a written application that just asks some of their experience and a couple of references. And then we go out to the home and meet with the family and see their house and talk about what sort of experiences they might have, as well as the background checks that we do.
All right. And, Craig, when you talk to a potential shelter parent, what do you tell them about the Country Roads program? And you've got 1 minute to do that.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Rick. So the biggest message that we have for them is the way that we support our shelter parents. Again, you know, Georgiana mentioned the 24-hour access line. Most shelter parents have a direct line to our Country Roads staff. And we really make sure that we understand that they are providing a service that's important to the community and that we're here to support them through that. And that's really the message that we give. And beyond that, we don't have to do a lot. You know, the kind of people who are interested in being shelter parents know and understand what's happening in the moment. And they really want to plug in and find opportunities to help.
That's Craig Pinkham. He is the executive director of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau. We've also been speaking with Colleen Carroll, Country Roads Youth and Family Counselor, and Georgiana Birmingham, the program's director. I want to thank all three of you for being here. And listeners, you can check out and learn more. The website is wcysb.org. Thanks again to all three of you today.
You're welcome, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. You. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll be back to catch up with one of the WDEV All-Stars, Brian Harwood. And today at 1 o'clock, it's Travels with Charlie, hosted by Charlie Papillo. That's followed by 2 hours of great music on The Getaway with Mr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. One of the great parts of being at WDEV right now is this opportunity to celebrate the station's wonderful 9 decades of broadcasting and getting to interview the many all-stars who have worked here through the years, who have informed you and entertained you. Another of the greats joins me now, Vermont Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame member Brian Harwood is my guest. Brian, great to have you on the show this morning. Welcome.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Brian about his years with WDEV or if you want to share a memory of one of his shows, perhaps as Maud Ferguson, you can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay, it was only 1954, so take us back to your first day on the job in radio.
Oh, brother. Well, it goes back before that, actually, because I was in make-believe radio land when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and my mother gave me a room, a very small room, like a cubbyhole, and I used to go in there with a card table, and I made a microphone out of a little teeny orange box, and I wish I'd kept it because it was a work of art. And my radio call letters were WSCS, which I think was some Christian women's society somewhere. And I would sit in there and rebroadcast. After school, I would rebroadcast Superman and other shows that were available on WDEV. So my career actually began in that little room. And then she gave me a larger room upstairs, actually a small bedroom. And I wired that thing up so that I had a little switch that I could throw that turned on a red light outside of the room so people would know that great activity was happening inside of the room. And the range of that signal was literally inside that room.
Oh,
but I had he was a doctor. He had an old examining table that I used as my table. I made a console out of an apple crate. with a piece of masonite and some wooden kitchen knobs that I found. And I finally found a microphone. It took me a long time to find a microphone, but I did. I had two turntables and a tape recorder, and I was all set to broadcast. And I did. But again, it went only inside the room. So when I was, and I grew up next door to Rusty Parker, the legendary Rusty Parker.
Okay.
And so he knew from the beginning of my life, because he was older than I, that my real career want was in radio. So when I, before my voice changed, actually, I went into the station as often as I could and just hung around. And I did that for several years until maybe I was 14. That would have been, that would have been about, the years of... gone by so fast. Anyway, whatever year it was, my voice did change. And because WDEV at the time owned the station in St. Albans, WWSR, that was kind of like the farm club for radio at WDEV. So the general manager up there was a fellow who lived in Waterbury, fortunately, because I was so young I didn't have my driver's license. So he would drive me up each day to WWSR, and I was on the air up there with, the staff that was up there, very small staff, great radio station, had a lot of experience. I would once went out and interviewed a client, brought back the information, wrote some copy for the ad, and then read the ad on the air. So it doesn't get much more on the ground than that. And then Ken Squire was also up there working at the same time, off and on, and he did have his driver's license, but I think that was about the time that he went off to college. So then I did get my driver's license, and I went up for, I guess, two summers up there and worked in the summer, and then began my shifts at WDEV, and that was glorious. I remember being, I don't remember actually what it was like to be on the air there for the first time, but all of that time, and that goes back, as you said, until 1954,
mm-hmm.
was just, and I was there off and on. I did, the weekend shows. I had a couple of businesses.
Yeah.
And then after I had an advertising agency in Stowe, and I would go on with Mike Carey then in the morning and do the morning news stuff and then leave and go up and do my advertising agency stuff in Stowe. And that continued after, well, I'll stop there in case you're sort of babbling here. But,
what a great career start. I love that it started in that little cubbyhole with the orange box as a microphone. But you were in training for years. How did radio change in the time you started in 1954 until you signed off in about 2012?
Well, first of all, when I started, I didn't have one, but the wire recorder was fun. How that ever worked, I don't know, but
right.
I remember Rusty Parker showing me once. Rusty was an inveterate smoker. In fact, sometimes he did two shows at once. He would come in the morning and do his 5 o'clock show, which was called Once Around the Clock, and I think still is.
It still is, yeah.
And while he was doing that show, he would tape another show at the same time. Sometimes he'd have two or three cigarettes going at once in the studio because it was okay to smoke there then. But he showed me how you spliced a wire recorder. You made a little knot in the wire, and then you held a cigarette, a burning cigarette, against the knot, and it would solder the knot together. That was something that I don't think ever happened a lot, but... yeah, I forget where, as usual, I've...
Well, that's okay. Brian, I find that incredible that Rusty Parker could run two shows and three cigarettes at the same time.
It's true.
Oh, that's amazing. And
only once in a while, he'd get them mixed up every once in a while.
Yeah. Now, let's see. What show am I on and which cigarette am I smoking?
Right, exactly. He had a show called Tip Top Time, which was... and he used to sing the theme to it.
Mm.
Rusty was many talented, multi-talented. Oh, my God. He once took the lyrics to Gentle on My Mind and turned it into a poem. Jimmy Webb wrote that song, of course, and the mm-hmm. lyrics. And Rusty records somewhere. It's there. Check with Charlotte and see if she can find it.
All right.
With him reciting the words to General on My Mind, and he had a train in the background, the sound of a train in the background. It's gorgeous. Oh, he also did the famous interview with the deer that we used to play on the opening day of deer hunting camp. Deer
That's season. Right.
I think those are there somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think they've made their way yet onto the air for the 90th. So that means Char was probably still hunting them down. You said you worked with Kenley back in the day. You probably worked with Ken Squire for a good portion of the time here. So what was it like working with Kenley?
Well,
and Kenley was probably listening right now. So
he didn't have his feet were not nailed to the floor. Let me put it that way. So, and I remember when he was at BU, he would come back, on the weekends. We did a show called Green Mountain Ballroom, which was an all-request show that occasionally would take live and go up to the high school and broadcast from the high school and have a dance there. It was kind of early disc jockey dance music. But Ken and I then later, our careers diverged. He went off and did his stuff with racing. I was also part of that. Way, way back when we were both in high school, and he would go up. I remember once going up to Morrisville. There was a dirt track in back of what was the Union Carbide plant. I think the building is still there. And on Saturday afternoons, they would have these races, jalopy races. And at the end of one of them, there was a dispute over who had won the race, and two of the drivers got into a terrible fist fight. And I was... He and I retired under the flatbed truck that was there and then went back to the radio station and went into this little small studio next to the mezzanine. And he reconstituted the race. And I was the sound of the cars going around. And then later, much later, after our careers had kind of come back together, we bought a station together in Stowe. This must have been somewhere in the 70s because I had been working in Washington and come back up here and was looking for something to do. So we bought the station, WRFB it was. No, wait a minute. That was the station we actually... We created that station. I'm sorry. I've got it backwards. We built that station with another fellow named Bill Riley, who is active in the Stowe Mansfield ski area.
All right.
And I was on the air there in the mornings from 6 until 9 with a show called AM on FM. The idea was to take an AM format, all kinds of music, very eclectic. And then we were... automated. We had these tape recorders and so on that would carry the programming through the day until night. And then at 8, we had a classical music show on that station, which we ultimately sold to a former disc jockey at WBZ named Larry Justice. And he held that station for a number of years, and then he sold it. And then subsequently, Ken and I and Bill Riley bought the station back. They actually bought the frequency back.
I love it.
And then put that station on the air as WRFB. And I'm sorry, again, I'm backwards. We bought that station back and created a classical station called WCVT, which is still on the air, just across the hall from you as 101.1.
You are correct.
And I was on that station for 17 years in the morning. I did a morning classical drive show from 6 until 8. And then I had an ad agency, and so at 8 o'clock, I would go up there and do the ad agency stuff. So it was quite a life.
Yeah, I don't think your feet were nailed to the floor either. And let's go to the phones, talk to Stephen in Montpelier. Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Rick. I just have a question for Brian, and that is whether he can reflect on Ray Burke singing to the snowplow drivers in the winter.
All right.
Yeah. Ray was one of a kind. Ray was I guess a lot of people knew that Ray was partially blind. So a lot of the things that he did, it was only oral for Ray, and he was great. He would communicate with all of the truck drivers all over the state, and then when he got on the air, he and Annie ran a farm up there in Montpelier, and he was a character. I remember once when he had a birthday, Madeline Cunin called us and wished him the governor, wow, wished him a happy birthday. I forgot whether she sang it to him or not, but yeah. And he used to, had a great sense of humor and great phrases that he came up with. But yeah, that was a special time, and he was much loved throughout the state. So I think he actually retired before he left us, but what a character. What a great guy.
Oh, I love it. Great memory there, Stephen. And let's go next to Shelburne and talk to Ted. Hi, Ted.
Yes, good morning. Ray Burke was a vital part of our upbringing here. And I'd love to have a sentence or so just about the time you mentioned in Washington. And we go back to, I think in the early-ish 60s, I had a sort of a pop-up ski lodge in the winter, and Brian was the voice for that, for a couple of ads, and then later joined my brother in a pottery partnership, and again, we had another pop-up kind of a gift shop at the holiday times, and our voice was Brian's at that time. So, but I missed the early stages. I was delighted to hear the closet story, and glad that it's carrying on.
Well, Brian, do you remember any of those pop-up places that Ted mentions, the ads you did back in the day?
Well, Ted was always kind of a pop-up guy. And he would pop up here and there. Most recently, he's been popping up overseas. So, yeah, I do. And so his brother George did great pottery and was up in off Route 15.
He's not young like me, but he's still doing something.
George Scatcherd?
George is still...
Yeah. Yep.
I have a beautiful...
Not young like me, but I saw him last night, and he can't get over it. He started an elementary school, and he's working at it.
I have one of his beautiful lamps, so kudos to George.
He's actually, he's been at it longer than I've been at radio, Ted.
Wow.
Well, I say, he's not young like me, and he was in grade school, and he had a great little art teacher at the Park School of Buffalo. There you go.
How neat is that? Well, Brian, I want to ask you about another thing. You were inducted into the Vermont Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame in 2006. That was 2 years before President Calvin Coolidge was inducted into that Hall of Fame. So either you're much older than I thought, or you're more important than I imagined. So which is it, Brian?
I won't go there. I do like to always say, though, that I'm younger than Ken Squire. And I will always be younger than Ken Squire. the odd part of that is that Calvin Coolidge and my grandfather were first cousins. My great-grandmother was present when Calvin Coolidge married his wife Grace, from Grace Goodhue from Burlington.
Yeah.
My great-grandmother was the only member of the Pollard family that was at that wedding on whatever street it was here in Burlington. I had nothing to do with getting him into the Hall of Fame, and why he's in the, I know it's because he was an early user of radio.
That's right.
As when he was the president, but no, I had to wait actually at least 2 years before they finally got to me in the Hall of Fame. There were other people that were much more deserving. So I did finally wait, but I'll tell you a funny story about what happened that night.
All right.
I recall the time Rusty Parker and I were at the station. It was a Saturday morning, and every Saturday morning at around 10:30, the UPI wire would type out this emergency notification notice. And the job of the place was they'd bring 10 bells on the UPI machine, which meant flash, flash, bulletin, bulletin. And you go in, and there was a code there. And if it was an actual alert,
the code would be typed onto the script. And on this wall of the newsroom was an envelope with which was not to be opened unless it was an actual alert. And there was a letter number code in there that corresponded to the actual alert. And that meant the Russians were coming, the Russians were coming.
Right.
And so we got the notification that said, this is not a test, it's an actual alert. Rusty and I went in and opened the envelope, and sure enough, it was authenticated. And so we spent a couple of minutes trying to figure out whether it really was or whether this was a mistake. And we finally decided that it was a mistake. And I told that story when I was brought into the Hall of Fame. And Ray Donovan, who used to sell time, was Ray over at Phil, I guess, at WSNO, was in the back of the room. And he said, I was on duty that morning, and I remember when that happened. Well, it turned out that there was an Army private, PFC, in Battle Creek, Michigan, and there were two sets of tapes, because everything that they put on was a tape. It was punch hole tape.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabbed the wrong one and grabbed the actual alert tape and fed that out to all of the UPI stations in the country. Fortunately, Rusty said, I don't think this is the real thing, so we didn't air it. But some stations did, actually.
I'm surprised we don't have that envelope still pegged to the wall here at our station. Hey, let's go to Barry next. We've got Gene joining us. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Well, I was born in Waterbury. Mm-hmm. And as Brian, I wonder if his father was a dentist there. And father or grandfather was a dentist there in Waterbury?
Anybody
no,
in the family?
Doctor, but he was a physician. He was a general practitioner in Waterbury.
Yeah, because my father went to him once, and I guess in I was born in Waterbury. And so, but I don't really remember Brian. I imagine he's younger than me. I'm pretty near 89. So.
Yeah, you got me by 6 years.
What was that, his grandfather or his father that was the doctor?
Father, my father, yeah.
Father, right. I know it was South one or the Street, other, but yeah. I don't think I ever knew Brian, so
yeah.
He's probably a lot younger than me anyway.
So. Well, he has 6 years. He's way young compared to you, quite your junior, Gene.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's nice to hear.
Oh, well, thank you, Gene, for the...
I was 13 when I moved from there, so...
Oh, I got you.
A few years.
Yep, all right.
Okay, well, thank you. You all have a good day.
All right, you too. Brian, do you miss doing radio?
Oh, yeah. That 2 hours in the morning was my beautiful time of the day.
Yeah.
And there were two reasons. First of all, I don't know if they run the fluorescent lights in the ceiling there, but I had two lights that were... It was kind of a subdued, almost like being in somebody's drawing room, reading room or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very quiet, of course, first thing in the morning. And I got to play all the music that I really, really like. So that's the part that I miss. What I don't miss is getting up and getting to the station at 5:30. That I don't miss a bit.
Now, no one who does morning radio who's ever done it revels in that. We have about a minute left, but what was your favorite part of all the years in radio and working here at WDEV?
Oh, Lord. Boy, that's hard. I think it was that last tour at WCVT and just being able to share that music. That's the way I thought about it. You know, these are all the things that I love, all the music that I love, and being able to share that with people and get the response back that, you know, if I remember the morning after 9/11, I played the finale to the Beethoven Ninth, which is that beautiful, beautiful chorus. And I remember a woman called me right after I played that and said, and she had a thick German accent and she was in tears. And she said, that summed it all up for me. And that summed it all up for me.
Ah. That is beautiful. Brian Harwood, one of the all-time greats in Vermont radio and inducted into the VAB's Hall of Fame in 2006. Brian, it's been an honor and a pleasure getting to chat with you this morning. Thank you so much.
Great. Great. Thank you.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update, then we'll be back to hear about what all the tweeting tells researchers about us. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. The Twitter sphere is constant and immense, but what might all those tweets tell researchers about how we're all doing? If you thought all those tweets were just a massive ball of randomness, think again. UVM computer science professor Chris Danforth has always suspected we can glean an awful lot from all that social messaging. And this morning we'll hear about how Chris goes about collecting the data and what he's learned from it. Listeners, if you've got a question or comment for Chris, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8244. Chris Danforth, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Happy to be here.
Oh, it is great to have you. All right. Start us off and tell us what the Computational Story Lab is.
Well, this is a research group that I co-direct with Peter Dodds here at UVM. We are a group of mathematicians, computer scientists, physicists, trying to understand how to make sense of all of the information that people share about their life, their interests on the internet. And so we do a bunch of research here at UVM. We teach courses on complex systems and data science. And, that's what we do.
And, boy, do we share on social media. How many tweets do you analyze in a typical day?
Yeah, the global volume of messages posted to that site is about 500 million messages a day, which if you wrote them on Post-it notes would wrap once around the Earth's equator, which I don't recommend doing.
You've tried that, and it's a tough task.
We get about 10% of them, a random 10%, and then we store them on big supercomputers here near Burlington. And so we've been doing this for almost 13 years now, and I've collected over 200 billion messages and done all kinds of research studies with them.
Wow, and that's an awful lot. So what kind of things are you looking for, and how do you analyze those tweets?
Yeah, we have a whole bunch of things we're interested in trying to understand. I think our biggest project tries to quantify how people are doing as they go about their life. We're quite good collectively as scientists at measuring things that that are easy to look at, and then they become important because we've measured them. So how much, how many cars are being imported, or, how many computers are being bought, things like that, they lend themselves to reflecting something about how we're all doing. And in that case, it's an economic indicator like gross domestic product or consumer confidence. Are we spending money? And, of course, if you ask somebody how they're doing, they may not care whether the country is selling more cars. They're going to have other stuff going on. And so it's quite difficult to have sort of a population scale representation of the direction people's lives are going in. And organizations like Gallup and Pew do surveys where they ask people questions about things like that. And about a decade ago, we decided to try and measure how people are doing closer to real time by understanding what the emotional content of their words being shared online were.
Now, Chris, we know there's scads of that out there in the different social media platforms, but how do you go about getting that, and collecting it. You don't have somebody sitting there just, you know, running through like my Facebook page or, you know, my tweets. So how is it done?
Yeah, we have computers that are collecting this random set of messages. And you're right, we don't have any individuals who are sitting around looking at them, but we might, you know, see that the word love is used, you know, 10 million times on a Saturday and only 9 million times on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And so if we, instead of, you know, just having a few words that we're looking at, we have, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of words that we've asked people, you know, individually how they feel about them, then we can get kind of a temperature for how people are doing. And so over the course of that, you know, 13 years that we've been doing this project at hedonometer.org, we've been able to reveal lots of things about how people's lives have changed over that period.
Well, I'm not surprised that there's less love on a Tuesday than a Saturday. I believe it was Kramer in Seinfeld who said, you know, Tuesday has no feel. But are there certain events that cause more happiness and others that cause far less?
Yeah, our instrument has shown basically, yeah, so the Saturdays tend to be happier. But we're also tend to be, you know, you see words like bored and drunk more often on Saturday as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, the main things that move the dial on this instrument are our U.S. holidays. So we see that people tend to be happier when they're spending time with their family and not needing to go to work, which makes sense. We also see, you know, collective trauma attached to specific punctuated events that we tend not to see coming, like natural disasters or terrorist attacks. Those tend to be the saddest periods for us. We did see, you know, our first big drop at the day of the Boston Marathon bombing for many years was the saddest event that we registered on this instrument. And then back at the beginning of the pandemic in March of 2020, we saw, you know, several weeks where the instrument was registering much lower than that Boston Marathon day. And so, you know, it indicated to us that, you know, something different was going on. And then at the end of May in 2020, after George Floyd's murder and the collective response, that was another period where there was a full week that was sadder than the instrument had ever registered. And actually, just last month, a separate group of researchers published a study of surveys from Gallup and Pew showing that adult Americans were as sad and angry during that period after the murder as they've ever been in their life. And so that was an indication that our instrument had picked up on something nearly in real time that you know, people were feeling.
What about holidays? Are we, you know, happier certain holidays than others?
Yeah, I mean, the instrument just generally says, okay, if people aren't going to work and, you know, and they're spending time with their family and their friends, that, you know, this is not surprising that could be a really good day for people. So, you know, there's occasionally some boredom on those days, but generally it's happiness.
All right. And then is happiness right now on the upswing or slumping? Where are we in real time? You can tell us how we're doing right now.
Yeah, so this instrument is, you know, it's really been trending up since that period of time in May. So people, you know, I think despite the scary numbers here locally in Vermont for the COVID positive tests, you know, I think that generally speaking, people are doing better today than they were a year ago now. The instrument, you know, we have this up on the internet showing how people are doing around the world in seven or eight languages. And so it's not always the case that they're in sync with each other, but it's been trending upwards of late.
Do you break it down geographically or regionally or by state?
Yeah, I think it's been quite a while actually since we've been able to do that well, because you probably heard there were some privacy concerns associated with how this data is used.
Right.
Let's say to target us with advertisements. So the companies, the social media companies, have made it a little bit less obvious where people are when they're posting messages, and they've sort of introduce a little bit of friction when it comes to the decision that you're making about sharing your GPS coordinates. Maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we did a study looking at those sorts of messages where we had precise geographic information and were able to see, for example, you know, Vermont tended to be one of the happier states in the U.S., and it's also a place where people were a little more emotionally constrained, but, you know, less of the more extreme emotional words on either end, less profanity here in Vermont. We also, you know, we've done some work looking at using messages like that, time spent outside. So, you know, you of course, know it's good for you to spend some time outside, and yet the sort of the economic benefit of natural space is something we don't have great comparisons for. So this is something we did looking at, you know, people went to a park, let's say, and compared how much happier their messages were surrounding that visit than they were during their regular day. And it was, as we've been talking about with holidays, it was about the same mood bump that you know, population of the U.S. experiences on this instrument when there's a holiday. So it's an indication that we all should get outside more often.
And Chris, we are all concerned about, you know, privacy matters and, you know, how this is used. So how is the data that you generate used ultimately?
Yeah, this is a really important component of this conversation because, you know, right now we have, you know, a real asymmetry in the ability for regular people to combat, you know, abuses of their privacy online.
Mm-hmm.
And there really aren't great regulations in place presently for how the data should be used. So one thing in the research we do that we're really careful about is that we never make public any information about any individual. When we publish studies, we adhere to the terms of service associated with the data to make sure everyone's privacy is protected. And, you know, by sort of imagining things like a temperature, like a thermometer, it's no individual molecule that is representing that temperature. It's the collection of them and the average of them over some period of time and space, and you could think of the instruments we build as acting like that, where we're reflecting collective experience and not that of any individual. Certainly, the social media companies, they, you know, that's how they make money.
Right.
A company like Facebook would make money from leveraging what they know about an individual to show them better advertisements. And so there's a question today about whether or not that business model is good for us collectively. And, you know, there's lots of examples recently where it seems like it hasn't been working well. And so, yeah, we just had actually, Shoshana Zuboff, who's a scholar who's written a book called Surveillance Capitalism, who has some suggestions about how to improve this situation to include potentially banning targeted advertisements. And, you know, we're quite attracted to stories that match our view of the world. And if companies that are able to share information with us take advantage of that, then it can become really difficult to understand what we're seeing, you know, what the mechanism behind it, what's produced that information. And so, yeah, the way forward is not clear, but I think regulation of this sort of data is definitely going to be involved.
Mm. Chris, how much does social media really reflect how people are thinking or feeling?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, and you know, there's lots of uses for the sites. I think you know, some of us go onto these sites to just understand what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
and don't interact with it ourselves. Other people are there to try and recruit people to a particular viewpoint, or just, you know, express how upset they are with the way things are going in their life or in the world. So there's a myriad of use cases, and you know, when you're on the site yourself, the people you've curated to show you their world, you know, that doesn't reflect how it all looks from other vantage points, and that's one of the challenges for analyzing this sort of data. You know, if you log into Facebook and look at the stories you're being told, it's, you know, that really is unique to you, and it's being determined not necessarily by people, but by computer programs that understand what your past behavior indicates you would like to see in the future. And so this is a very different situation than we've been in where, you know, you turn on the television and everybody's watching the same news story. It really does mean that there are different versions of reality being shown to people. And, you know, it's very challenging to analyze and understand, but really important, as we've seen, because, you know, with events like, you know, the vaccine, you know, people who are worried about the efficacy of the vaccine, people who believe the election was stolen. There's lots of cases recently where, you know, content that is being shared online really influences how people are feeling. So we do some work to try and understand the relationship. I mentioned the, you know, the reaction to George Floyd and how our hedonometer instrument agreed with people's survey responses of that period being one of great sadness and anger. You know, we're coming out of this collective trauma associated with a pandemic that our instrument revealed as well. You know, I think another good question, aside from, you know, how accurate a reflection of society is this data, is what, you know, what effect does using these platforms have on us individually? Mm-hmm. And those questions they're very difficult to answer as well, because there aren't a lot of people signing up to give up their Facebook account for a year to see how it goes. And so it's challenging.
Yeah. Well, I would think that people would be a little bit more, share their true personal feelings in more private ways, text, emails, maybe phone calls, than, you know, blaring it out in social media. But I'm probably wrong about that. The guy who uses his social media more for, you know, pushing his, I don't know, Scottish indie band that he's into this week, or the election results from, you know, Canada's federal election. We only have a few more minutes left. I know you are, like, researching hundreds of things. What else are you looking at of interest right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing moving forward that we're really interested in is trying to understand what types of stories people respond to. And, you know, so it was maybe 5 years ago now we published a study of literature. Actually, you know, it was back in the 70s, this, you know, famous author, Kurt Vonnegut, had proposed that there were only a few types of stories that are told, sort of the man in the hole story, where somebody gets into trouble and gets out of it, and that kind of story just gets retold over and over again. So we did some work demonstrating that he was right when looking at, you know, several thousand books and how successful they were, that there were really only a handful of emotional arcs that people were taken through, and similarly for movies. And so now I think, you know, what we're looking for in the future is to try and build, like I've been describing, this instrument for social media, but just, you know, some better text instruments that understand and can reflect our experience from text. And, you know, we have, you know, telescopes that tell us about the history of the universe. We have microscopes that help us understand how, you know, our biology evolves and you know, played a large role in trying to make sure that this vaccine was possible so quickly. But we don't really have good instruments that can tell us about what's going on in the world, you know, from the text that we share. And so I think, you know, in looking forward, we're going to be spending a lot of time trying to understand how to take all of the data, not just, you know, from Twitter, but things that people search for on Google or maybe, you know, things that people are watching, let's say the transcriptions of YouTube videos, let's say. So, if, you know, we're spending a trillion hours or something like that every week watching YouTube, maybe we could try and take the you know, that sort of data and understand what it is that's engaging people. And, you know, I think that as we try and collectively get through this period of time where, you know, we're a little more isolated than we have been in the past, it's really important to know, you know, what's helping us and what's hurting us. And if we're going to have stories that are hurting us collectively, we want to know about that ahead of time to help try and stop and, you know, maybe inoculate ourselves a bit against those types of stories.
Mm. Sounds like as long as there's an internet, Chris, you've got your work cut out for you. You've got stuff to investigate. Unbelievable amount of information that's out there that you can pour through. Chris Danforth is a computer science professor at UVM, and he's got all sorts of great research going on online. Chris, I have as your website cdanfort.w3.uvm.edu. Is that the easiest place for people to find what you're working on?
Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful. If you Google for any of this stuff, Hedonometer or my name, that would be enough too. But I appreciate it, Rick.
Yep. All right. Chris, always great to hear what you're working on. I loved having you on. Thanks.
Thanks, Rick.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please send topics or guest ideas my way. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. And we've got Veterans Day coming up. I mentioned I'd love to hear about guests you have that you'd like to suggest. If there's a veteran who you think would make a great interview for me to talk to this Thursday, please send it my way, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'd love to know. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Zingari. Tomorrow, some more WDV at 90. We're going to talk to Anson Tebbets, and we'll also meet artist Jennifer Bryan. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.